In a nation that celebrates hustle culture and glorifies the grind, sleep has become America's most dispensable commodity. Thomas Edison, perhaps our most influential sleep skeptic, boasted of needing just 4 hours of rest while working marathon sessions in his laboratory. Charles Lindbergh transformed his 33-hour transatlantic flight into a heroic battle against slumber, with newspapers celebrating his wakefulness as much as his aviation feat. And in our modern era, executives like Donald Trump proudly proclaim, "Don't sleep any more than you have to," dismissing snoozers as losers. This cultural rejection of sleep has deep historical roots, shaping everything from corporate cultures to federal regulations. Alan Derrickson's groundbreaking exploration reveals how America became uniquely resistant to rest, creating a society where millions suffer chronic sleep deprivation while their employers dream of endless productivity. The American romance with sleeplessness began well before Edison, but his legendary work habits cemented the association between minimal sleep and extraordinary achievement. The press eagerly promoted his claims of sleeping just 4 hours daily, creating a template for success that countless ambitious Americans would follow. Edison wasn't merely demonstrating personal discipline. He was performing a distinctly masculine form of self-denial that equated physical needs with weakness. After Edison, Charles Lindbergh became America's foremost symbol of heroic wakefulness. His solo transatlantic flight presented the ultimate sleep challenge. Nodding off meant certain death. Despite reportedly staying awake for over 33 hours, Lindbergh initially claimed he didn't really get what you might call downright sleepy, and insisted he could have flown half that distance again. The press celebrated his triumph over sleep as much as his aviation achievement, though Lindbergh later revised his account in his Pulitzer-winning memoir, describing a desperate battle against hallucinations and exhaustion that made his feat seem even more heroic. This anti-sleep ethos found academic reinforcement from psychology professor Donald Laird, who promoted reduced sleep through books like Increasing Personal Efficiency. Laird frequently cited Edison's supposed 2-hour sleep schedule and offered techniques to sleep less. Other self-help authors like Bob Hoffman and Dale Carnegie similarly celebrated sleep restriction as key to success. Importantly, this advice targeted men exclusively. For women, experts prescribed ample beauty sleep, warning that inadequate slumber would undermine attractiveness with dark circles, lifeless hair, and nervous tension. The gendered nature of sleep advice revealed deeper assumptions. Men were expected to sacrifice physical needs for achievement, while women were judged primarily on appearance. After World War II, extreme sleep deprivation briefly fell from favor as corporate culture embraced the well-rounded man who was rested and at peace. But this reasonableness proved short-lived. As America faced economic challenges from the 1970s onward, sleep deprivation returned as a badge of honor. Global competition, especially from Japan's corporate culture of overwork, reinforced the idea that sleep was a luxury winners couldn't afford. The Second Gilded Age brought charismatic executives who made sleeplessness central to their mystique. Walmart founder Sam Walton famously began his workday at 4 a.m. and surprised employees with 2:30 a.m. donut deliveries. His managers worked 90-plus hour weeks trying to keep pace. Women executives like Oprah Winfrey and Martha Stewart boasted of needing only 4 to 5 hours nightly, adopting this masculine standard as the price of admission to leadership roles. Professional football coaches similarly embraced sleep deprivation as a competitive edge. From George Hollis to John Gruden, who rose at 3:17 a.m. most days, NFL coaches routinely slept in their offices and expected similar dedication from staff. As one analysis noted, endurance is a way for someone like the minuscule John Gruden to prove his masculinity. Wall Street and the legal profession maintained this anti-sleep bias into the 21st century. Citibank's long-running slogan, "City Never Sleeps," celebrated corporate sleeplessness, while law firm associates faced the stark choice: would you rather sleep or win? In Silicon Valley, software engineers compare themselves to some real or mythic person, male, who works when they are asleep, with figures like Mark Zuckerberg portrayed in pure laser mode during all-night coding sessions. Throughout American history, prominent men have promoted various sleepless work styles, each carrying masculine markings. Franklin made wakefulness about self-control and industry, Edison about perseverance and innovation, Lindbergh about courage and self-reliance, and Trump about aggressiveness and vigilance. Together, they created a tradition of heroic, manly sleeplessness that continues to shape American work culture today. While influential men celebrated sleeplessness, American policy largely acquiesced to or encouraged overwork at the expense of sleep. Government interventions primarily targeted workers whose sleeplessness threatened public welfare, particularly wage-earning women whose reproductive capabilities were deemed a societal interest dependent on adequate rest. When protections for female workers eroded later in the century, women gained the dubious right to work around the clock like men. For most American workers whose fatigue endangered only themselves, policy relied on premium pay rather than hard limits. This approach created inherent tension by discouraging employers from imposing excessive hours while simultaneously incentivizing workers to accept them. This ambivalence dated back to early labor conflicts. Even in 1832, the New England Association of Farmers, Mechanics, and Other Working Men demanded 10-hour days only for those not receiving bonus pay for additional hours. The 1916 Adamson Act established the pattern of premium pay without hard limits by granting railroad workers an 8-hour basic day with time and a half compensation beyond that. During the Great Depression, the National Recovery Administration briefly established industry-specific codes limiting hours primarily to distribute scarce employment opportunities. After the Supreme Court struck down the NRA in 1935, the Fair Labor Standards Act of 1938 emerged as a compromise that abandoned earlier proposals to restrict night work, instead implementing only a 50% pay premium for work beyond 40 weekly hours, with many industries exempted. World War II exacerbated overwork through economic mobilization. Sleep scientist Nathaniel Kleitman, the father of modern American sleep science, advised against frequent shift rotation and proposed innovative shift schedules, noon, 8 p.m., 4 a.m., that minimized sleep disruption. The Department of Labor promoted his red, white, and blue shift system, but implementation remained inconsistent. The wartime influx of women into defense jobs led to suspension of state laws barring women's night work. The Women's Bureau fought to minimize these reversals, warning that household duties during the day plus work at night will cause chronic fatigue. Bureau investigators documented women struggling with sleep-disrupting weekly rotations in industries like steel manufacturing. After the war, gender-specific labor protections faced increasing attacks. Some defenders, like Johns Hopkins public health professor Anna Bajer, shifted from biological arguments to social ones, noting women's disproportionate household responsibilities made nighttime employment particularly burdensome. The Women's Bureau adopted this perspective, arguing in 1949 that women's fatigue stemmed not from lower physical stamina, but in their greater practical difficulty in getting daytime sleep. By 1963, the President's Commission on the Status of Women reluctantly accepted night work for women, suggesting only that third shift assignments be optional. The Commission stated that night work, especially on the graveyard shift, is undesirable for most people, but preferred regulations over prohibitions. The Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's 1969 ruling that gender-specific labor laws violated Title VII of the Civil Rights Act delivered the final blow, granting women the dubious equality to work around the clock without any corresponding equality in household responsibilities. In the final quarter of the 20th century, scientific advances and changing economic patterns prompted reassessment of sleep deprivation's health effects. About one-sixth of the workforce worked non-standard shifts by the 1970s as consumer society demanded 24-hour access to goods and services. The 1970 Occupational Safety and Health Act established NIOSH to identify workplace hazards, but despite recognition of sleep disturbance as the leading problem of shift work, OSHA took no regulatory action. High-profile disasters involving sleep-deprived workers kept federal attention intermittent. Congress created the National Commission on Sleep Disorders Research in 1988, which recommended reviewing transportation sector working time regulations. The Office of Technology Assessment suggested in 1991 that Congress direct OSHA to consider hours of work standards, but legislators declined, reflecting the conservative political climate. This minimalistic approach to workers' sleep deprivation aligns with broader American public health policy, which historically intervenes forcefully only when widespread fear of serious infection threatens society as a whole. The state has rarely committed resources to preventing non-infectious conditions that endanger no second parties. At the turn of the 20th century, American steelworkers endured a brutal system of long hours that guaranteed sleep deprivation. In mills operating 24/7, 365, workers faced 12-hour days and 7-day weeks, totaling 84 hours weekly. Most punishing was the long turn, a 24-hour double shift workers endured every other weekend when rotating from day to night shifts. This schedule, combined with uncomfortable sleeping quarters, produced widespread shift work sleep disorder and workplace injuries. The system emerged from dramatic power imbalances between labor and capital. Technological advances like the Bessemer process and open hearth technology had devalued traditional ironworking skills, creating numerous unskilled positions filled largely by Eastern European immigrants. Andrew Carnegie's crushing defeat of the Amalgamated Association of Iron and Steel Workers at Homestead in 1892 eliminated the only real countervailing power in the industry. Before 1892, 8-hour shifts had existed in some plants. Carnegie himself had once advocated 3 8-hour shifts for continuous operations, and his superintendent Bill Jones had praised shorter hours for allowing workers 16 hours to rest. But Carnegie reversed course in 1887, locking out employees at the Edgar Thompson Works and imposing 12-hour shifts. After Homestead, the 12-hour day became standard across the industry. The 7-day schedule, once limited to blast furnaces where shutdowns would damage equipment, expanded after 1892 to roughly a quarter of all production workers by 1910. Despite U.S. Steel's 1907 declaration of intent to abolish 7-day schedules, implementation remained inconsistent, especially during World War I's labor shortages. Most devastating was the weekly rotation between day and night shifts. Rather than allowing workers to adjust over longer periods, most mills flipped shifts every week, with some using biweekly changes. The transition from days to nights required the infamous long turn, a 24-hour shift beginning Sunday morning. After 12 hours off Monday, workers returned at 6 p.m. for a week of night work. The novelist Thomas Bell described the second 12 hours of a long turn as a state where exhaustion slowly numbed his body, mercifully fogged his mind. He ceased to be a human being. Steel executives refused to acknowledge sleep deprivation as a problem, instead boasting of their own supposed stamina. Andrew Carnegie spoke of problems which tax the minds of businessmen during the dark hours of the night when their employees are asleep. William Field, a U.S. Steel superintendent, claimed he once worked 72 sleepless hours troubleshooting a problem. Chairman Elbert Gary could not comprehend why any other man should be unwilling to work as long and as hard as he had. The sleep deprivation was severe. Workers on night shifts often managed only 3 to 5 hours of sleep per day. Even this meager rest was frequently interrupted, what researcher Margaret Byington called broken sleep. Daytime sleepers contended with crying babies, playing children, and household noise. In Thomas Bell's novel, an exhausted laborer tried to sleep during an August day, but sprawled on a bed that grew sticky with his sweat, gasped for air, and in wakeful sleep kept confusing the buzzing of flies with sounds from the mill, while his baby whimpered endlessly in the kitchen. Housing conditions exacerbated sleep problems. Low pay and housing shortages forced many workers to share beds with multiple people, exposing them to snoring, coughing, and restless movements. Some workers combined simultaneous and sequential bed sharing, with four men using one bed in rotation. Overcrowding was extreme. Pittsburgh's South Side had 84 residents per acre by 1890, with buildings subdivided into tiny rooms. Half of Slavic immigrant families had someone sleeping in the kitchen. The worst overcrowding occurred in boarding houses run by immigrant families who took in single laborers. Margaret Byington discovered one Bulgarian family of four sharing their modest homestead home with 20 boarders, fitting 24 people into just two rooms. During winter, everyone slept in the kitchen, the only warm place. Workers developed coping strategies to minimize sleep deprivation. Many simply collapsed from exhaustion after shifts, falling asleep on streetcars while commuting home. As one worker recalled, "When I got home in the evening, all I would do is go to sleep. I couldn't even pick up a piece of bread. My fingers were so racked up." Some workers became slumber camels, storing up sleep before long turns. Many sacrificed rare free Sundays to catch up on lost sleep rather than socialize or attend church. Some workers managed to nap during shifts. Engine operators dozed in their cabs between trips, and blast furnace workers napped during downtime. Night shifts offered the best opportunities for on-site slumber, with one open hearth laborer noting that at 4 a.m., sleeping was pretty general, including boss. Some foremen explicitly permitted napping, announcing at shift start that everyone would get at least an hour to sleep. Many workers turned to alcohol to secure sleep at home. The whiskey beer ritual, downing a shot of whiskey followed by a beer, was common practice after shifts. Workers drank for the purpose of making sure that they would get a better day's sleep through all the daytime noises, and to counteract the coffee they consumed to stay awake during shifts. The toll of sleeplessness manifested in workplace injuries. Crystal Eastman's study of occupational accidents in Allegheny County documented two fatalities involving sleeping workers. A 15-year-old who dozed in a wheelbarrow during his 13-hour night shift and was struck by a late alarm, and an 18-year-old who fell asleep in a buggy and was crushed by an iron bucket. Reform efforts began in earnest with the Pittsburgh Survey of 1907-8, a monumental investigation funded by the Russell Sage Foundation and led by Paul Kellogg. Their findings highlighted the unrested predicament of mill workers. After completing his work on the Pittsburgh Survey, John Fitch made steel hours his personal crusade, publishing his findings in the Survey magazine and testifying in congressional hearings. The end of World War I brought no reduction in working time. In 1919, about half of U.S. Steel's workforce still worked 12-hour shifts, and industry-wide hours were longer than in 1910. This frustration fueled a massive organizing drive launched in fall 1918. On July 20, 1919, the Amalgamated Association of Iron, Steel, and Tin Workers and its partners issued 12 demands, prominently featuring the 8-hour day, weekly rest, double pay for overtime and holidays, and abolition of the 24-hour long turn. After failed federal mediation, the National Committee called an industry-wide strike for September 22, 1919, declaring, "Now is the time to insist on our rights as human beings." Initially, about half the industry's 500,000 workers joined the strike. However, the well-prepared employers unleashed a devastating counterattack using private security forces, loyal employees, imported strikebreakers, and sympathetic media. On January 8, 1920, the National Committee conceded defeat, winning no concessions. Despite this defeat, the strike advanced hours reform by drawing attention to workers' plight. The Interchurch World Movement of North America's July 1920 report received extensive publicity, redirecting conversation from alleged immigrant radicalism to substantive issues like working hours. The report condemned the long turn as inhuman and called for abolishing both the 12-hour day and 7-day week. President Warren Harding, a conservative Republican, urged steelmakers to abandon the exceptionally long day. In 1922, the Federated American Engineering Societies published a lengthy assessment from economic and technical perspective. Harding's foreword emphatically portrayed long hours as archaic. The old order of the 12-hour day must give way to a better and wiser form of organization of the productive forces of the nation. After continued pressure, steel industry leader Elbert Gary and his colleagues finally agreed to discontinue the 12-hour day in mid-1923. Beyond external pressure, the industrialists had seen evidence that shorter hours were economically feasible and could increase efficiency and productivity. The end of the 12-hour day and 24-hour long term substantially improved steelworkers' chances for adequate sleep. Average weekly hours for blast furnace employees fell from 72 in 1922 to 60 in 1924, with similar declines in open hearth departments. Unfortunately, weekly or biweekly rotation schemes remained in place, continuing to disrupt workers' circadian rhythms for decades to come. During 1915 hearings by the U.S. Commission on Industrial Relations, railway sleeping car porter G.H. Sylvester revealed the impossible sleep situation facing Pullman Company employees. When asked about opportunities to rest on his overnight run from New York to Chicago on the 20th Century Limited, the 20-year veteran stated bluntly, "You ain't supposed to get any sleep." Porters were expected to prepare berths for passengers and meet their needs for comfortable rest while being denied that same basic necessity themselves. Like steelworkers, Pullman porters endured extremely long hours and unnatural schedules. Their situation was distinguished by very frequent departures from barely regular schedules and management's expectation that they attempt to sleep in public spaces. This combination virtually guaranteed injurious sleep deprivation. African-American sleeping car employees and their union leaders developed a keen awareness of the health risks posed by inadequate and disrupted rest, well before sleep science existed as an established field. The Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters, BSCP, framed the issue as one of sleep denial, making clear that management decisions were the primary cause of porters' deficient rest. This forceful advocacy helped undermine the Pullman Company's image of benevolent paternalism and established rest as a legitimate health concern. Prior to unionization, porters worked extraordinarily long hours, approximately 400 hours monthly with no specified limits. Unlike train operating crews, they weren't covered by the Hours of Service Act of 1907. Their work was calculated based on miles traveled, 11,000 per month, rather than hours, leaving them unpaid for substantial preparation time. On long runs like the Chicago to Oakland route, porters might work 48 to 60 hours without rest, sometimes fainting from exhaustion. Management frequently engaged in doubling back, ordering porters to immediately take another trip after completing their scheduled run. Pullman's policies regarding onboard sleep actually regressed after 1900. Rules from 1874 granting porters rest from 10 p.m. to 3 a.m. were gradually eroded and eventually eliminated. Porters were required to maintain night watches to guard against thieves sitting on uncomfortable stools nicknamed Broncos. A 1920 study found only 23% of porters sleeping more than 3 hours daily, with 16% getting no regular sleep on the rails. Those caught sleeping on duty faced suspensions and loss of bonuses. In 1925, dissident porters formed the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters and selected A. Philip Randolph as their leader. The union immediately elevated sleep deprivation as a central organizing issue. Despite their gains, porters remained frustrated by sleep deductions and doubled workloads that left them utterly exhausted with little family time. T. Walter Jones observed, after interviewing 150 colleagues, that their wives and children complained about lack of companionship because the men are so utterly exhausted that rest and sleep are imperative. The spatial aspects of rest presented ongoing challenges. the BSCP concentrated on improving onboard accommodations, targeting the smoking room couch and men's washroom couch where porters slept in contaminated environments separated from passengers only by curtains. These spaces also increased safety hazards during accidents, with derailments sending porters flying into peril. In 1944, Jacksonville porters complained that noise and disturbances left workers sleepless for 3 or 4 consecutive nights. Pullman resisted eliminating the smoking room sofa until 1953, when the BSCP finally secured a contract ending this practice. By its 30th anniversary in 1955, the union celebrated this abolition as one of its major accomplishments. The BSCP's achievements were remarkable considering the racism that hindered advances. The prevailing racial order assumed black jobs should be bad jobs. White rail brotherhoods rejected industry-wide solidarity that would include sleeping car workers. Porters also lacked biomedical validation for their sleep-related illnesses in an era of healthcare segregation, while Pullman promoted victim-blaming rather than addressing complaints. Beyond concrete gains, the BSCP contributed by highlighting previously under-recognized problems. Their critique emphasized holistic well-being rather than specific physical ailments, perhaps to counter racial stereotypes. This approach challenged employer paternalism by demonstrating that workers couldn't devote boundless energy without serious consequences. The sleep denial critique resonated with porters because it tapped into their desire for workplace respect and highlighted the paradoxical indignity that they ensured comfortable sleep for others while being denied it themselves. Unlike most workers, long-haul truckers face potential death from falling asleep while working. Since the 1920s, these drivers have endured chronic sleep deprivation regardless of industry regulation status. The trucking profession developed as a distinctly masculine domain, a reaction to women's increasing presence behind automobile wheels. By 2000, women comprised only 4% of truckers, mostly in short-haul positions. Highway settings became stages for public performances of masculine endurance. Sociologist Kenneth Ouellette observed how drivers develop their identity through interactions with roadside audiences, with fellow truckers deriding as weaklings those who worked only 12-hour days or took breaks after 4 hours driving. The independence of trucking has always attracted workers. Owner-operators epitomize this pursuit of freedom, occupying a unique position between working class and small business owner. This independence, celebrated in popular culture like the 1940 film They Drive by Night, has undermined organized attempts to establish reasonable work limits and safeguard adequate sleep. Long-distance freight trucking emerged significantly after World War I. Military training gave working-class men vehicle operation skills, while wartime agricultural demand led farmers to invest in hauling equipment. Truck production doubled between 1918 and 1925, reaching 500,000 vehicles annually. The federal government responded to poor road conditions with massive highway construction, creating a 226,000-mile national network by 1935. The Great Depression transformed trucking into a desperate gamble for many. One-man, one-truck operations proliferated, with over 80% of trucking enterprises operating just one vehicle by the Depression's depths. This hyper-competitive market generated brutal overwork. Independent trucker Bert Glupker exemplified this reality, delivering farm products across the Midwest while sleeping mainly in his truck seat and once making a 4-night round trip without any sleep, using cold water splashes to stay awake. The New Deal's attempt to bring stability to trucking aligned with its broader economic goals. The National Industrial Recovery Act of 1933 launched a corporatist scheme for industry self-regulation, with most industries adopting 40-hour work weeks. Trucking, however, proved exceptional. The hastily formed American Trucking Associations faced off against the Teamsters, who pressed for 40-hour weeks with premium pay beyond 8 hours daily and a 10-hour daily maximum. The NRA's February 1934 rules heavily favored employers, allowing truckers to work 108 hours over 2 weeks with minimal overtime premiums. Implementation proved spotty, with many firms ignoring registration requirements and exploiting loopholes. Even as the NRA faltered, plans developed to place trucking under Interstate Commerce Commission oversight. ICC Commissioner Joseph Eastman, appointed Federal Transportation Coordinator by Roosevelt, documented the industry's chaotic conditions and recommended federal regulation. The Motor Carrier Act of August 1935 authorized the ICC to regulate market entry and interstate freight rates while deferring the contentious issue of working time limits to future ICC rulemaking. Eastman's investigation revealed alarming patterns. A third of truckers worked over 60 hours weekly. A quarter of driving shifts lasted at least 16 hours, and some independent operators made 60-hour nonstop runs. Sleep deprivation was endemic, especially among owner-operators desperate to avoid truck repossession. One Michigan operator got just 14 hours sleep across 5 days, while another received only 22 hours sleep during a 137-hour work week. The consequences included hallucinations, drivers nodding off during conversations, and numerous collisions. Despite clear evidence linking long hours to accidents, Eastman hesitated to impose strict limits without more definitive scientific data on fatigue thresholds. When the ICC finally issued its hours of service regulations in December 1937, effective July 1938, it explicitly distinguished between mere drowsiness and more severe fatigue requiring recovery periods. This distinction effectively normalized drowsy driving, with regulators claiming insufficient evidence linking specific work durations to unsafe driving within their proposed limits. The ICC adopted weak standards requiring drivers to log their time but providing minimal protection. The regulations were immediately revised, first limiting consecutive driving to 10 hours with 8 hours rest, which could be split in sleeper cabs, then allowing 12 straight hours of driving in emergency conditions. These weak standards would remain essentially unchanged for over 60 years. The ICC's promise of a comprehensive scientific study of driver fatigue offered hope for stronger regulations. By June 1938, Eastman arranged for the U.S. Public Health Service to investigate, though Surgeon General Thomas Perrin cautioned they might not produce definitive guidelines. Led by R.R. Sayers, PHS researchers failed to focus on the critical relationship between working time and accidents. Instead, they pursued the elusive goal of measuring driver fatigue objectively. The 1941 report, Fatigue and Hours of Service of Interstate Truck Drivers, confirmed that longer driving periods produced slower reactions and less steadiness. Yet the PHS avoided making specific recommendations about maximum hours or minimum sleep requirements, offering only vague conclusions that reasonable limitation of hours would improve safety. This irresolute outcome left the ICC's weak regulations intact. Despite mounting scientific evidence, federal regulators maintained inadequate hours of service rules. In 1989, the NTSB initiated reconsideration of these antiquated regulations, with expert panels criticizing the unnatural 18-hour restart cycle that violates everything known about circadian cycles. Yet the Department of Transportation remained narrowly focused on accident prevention rather than addressing long-term health consequences of sleep deprivation. The 2003 revised regulations restored 24-hour cycling but retained the 60-70-hour weekly limits and actually increased daily driving time to 11 hours. Progressive advocacy group Public Citizen challenged these weak regulations, noting they existed only because of a 1937 exemption from fair labor standards. A federal court agreed in 2004, with Judge Sentell observing the FMCSA hadn't considered drivers' health in the slightest. The Bush administration reissued essentially identical rules in 2005, dismissively claiming the regulations were shift neutral and posed no greater risk to driver health than previous ones. After further legal challenges, even the Obama administration proposed only modest revisions in 2010, maintaining the 60-70-hour weekly limits while adding requirements for nighttime rest periods. This regulatory stalemate reflects the industry's structural problems, with owner-operators often opposing stricter regulations due to economic pressures. Without strong union advocacy or regulatory intervention, the nightmare of sleeplessness continues for many drivers. Flexibility has become the defining catchword of our era, much as efficiency dominated the early 20th century. From yoga to lean organizations, American culture now celebrates constant adaptation and multitasking. Sleep deprivation has become normalized as essential for survival in a globally competitive 24/7, 365 world, with Americans developing stronger ideological justifications than ever for distrusting dormancy. The proliferation of non-standard work schedules reflects mounting demands for flexibility, with about 20% of the U.S. workforce now challenged by night, weekend, and rotational shifts that disrupt biological rhythms. Despite the rhetoric of flex time, control over scheduling remains predominantly with managers rather than employees, especially in non-union settings. Only about a quarter of workers exercise significant control over their schedules. This trend has created a sleep divide in American society, with perpetually drowsy workers disproportionately concentrated in low-wage service sectors. Some progress is emerging through workplace napping programs, with companies like Huffington Post offering napping rooms for sleepy staff. As Arianna Huffington argued when defending napping rooms for air traffic controllers, shouldn't those making sure planes take off and land safely be given the same option? Unions can help by negotiating rest breaks, limiting mandatory overtime, and discouraging non-standard schedules through premium pay requirements. The AFL-CIO has even launched initiatives using health grievances in organizing campaigns. Beyond immediate possibilities, public policy innovations could address shift work sleep disorder by implementing Article 24 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, which affirms everyone's right to rest and leisure. The U.S. could join over 90 nations requiring at least one day off weekly and 80 nations setting maximum workweek lengths. OSHA could potentially construe sleep-denying work arrangements as legitimate workplace hazards, drawing on NIOSH expertise to prevent the damage caused by overwork and sleep disruption. The struggles of steelworkers, Pullman porters, and truckers offer encouragement to those fighting for the right to sleep against employers who treat sleep problems as disciplinary rather than medical matters. America has reduced average sleep time by 20% over the past century, creating a society where millions suffer chronic sleep deprivation due to workplace demands and lifestyle choices. By 2007, 30% of American workers slept 6 hours or less daily, with manufacturing, transportation, and night shift workers suffering most acutely. Beyond sheer duration, non-standard work schedules have profoundly disrupted sleep quality, affecting one-fifth of full-time employees. The historical relationship between sleep and work reveals America's exceptional pattern of overwork, increasing by 160 hours annually, while other affluent nations reduced working time. This pattern has severely diminished time for rest, creating a public health crisis that remains largely unaddressed by policymakers. As we confront this crisis, we must recognize that adequate sleep isn't a luxury or sign of weakness, it's a biological necessity and human right. The question isn't whether we can afford to let people sleep, it's whether we can afford not to.